All right, so we have for practical purposes two more weeks because the last week is really just one day. So I want to get through the material I'm going to start today. And then what I'm going to do for the rest of the semester is talk about two worked examples that we've been through in the Aero system that try to pull all these pieces together and sort of show how they compose to do things that are a little tricky. One being the window system and the other being the network subsystem. And I'll tell you a little bit about the plan and the design for the browser that we did, the secure browser that we did, and you know, sort of go through some examples. What I'm also going to do, and I'm going to try to get it out next this coming Monday, I'm going to do a final that works pretty much the same way the midterm worked, okay? Except I'm going to try to allow 2 weeks for it. And it may involve, it's likely to involve some more intensive design thinking than the midterm did because it's longer. On the other hand, we'll get it done, you know, before reading period, and you know, and then we got this one out of the way. Just out of curiosity, how many of you have other projects and other courses that are piling up at the end of the semester that I'm about to make a big pain in the ass for? A few.
It always happens.
Okay, well, you know, I'm just not going to ask if you'd rather not have an exam, because I already know the answer to that, but, okay. So I asked you folks to read two papers on exokernel and a paper on DPF, and I'll wager that half of you didn't. You'll get yours, if you didn't. And I would strongly encourage you to go back and read the paper on V-code, and I don't remember if I put that one on the list. Look, it's not that I want you guys to know all the details of how V-code works. That's not the important part. But hiding in that V-code paper, there's a very simple and quite brilliant idea that has lots of potential applications. One caveat about the V-code work is that the numbers exaggerate. And what I mean by that is, you know, Dawson is a very careful researcher, and whatever numbers he reported you can rely on are accurate, but there's a bug in the implementation that impacts the numbers. The way V-code works is, you start and you allocate a buffer and it appends instructions to this buffer. Unfortunately, it doesn't check when the buffer has run out. And so the reported claim in the paper that it takes about 10 host instructions to generate each target instruction is actually not correct if you want to do it safely. So there's, and I consider that a bug, and we could argue about whether it's a bug. If you think you can predict the outcome well enough, then maybe it's a non-issue. I don't think you can. All the evidence I've seen is every time somebody bets that way, they get it wrong. And so I'd rather spend the extra two instructions to check. Oh well. Let me try to give you a sense of where that work is coming from. And I'm not clear if the sequence of events was that Dawson pulled together this V-code thing and then said, what can I do with it? Or the other way around, that Dawson was looking at a packet filter problem and then came up with V-code as a way to solve it. I've never actually thought to ask him, and I should. He went on to use a V-code derivative in a later piece of work called TIXI, which I'll do a drive-by on, hopefully. So here's the idea. And now I'm backing up to something called the Berkeley packet filter. In the earliest network stacks, the problem is I get a packet that comes in, and I very quickly have to decide what to do with it, because the packet rate is pretty fast. And one of the very earliest tasks I have to do is I have to classify the packet according to what protocol it is, whether it needs to go through the IP reassembly process, if it's even an IP packet, it might be an ARP packet, what port the packet is going for, right? Lots of things like this. So basically a packet comes in off the wire and there's very, very quickly this fan out of options that dictate how I'm going to go to handle this packet. And a lot of the decisions in this fan-out are surprisingly tricky. For example, I not only want to know that it's an IP packet, but once I know that it's an IP packet, I want to know if it's a TCP versus a UDP packet. And once I know it's a TCP versus a UDP packet, I'd actually like to figure out which port on my machine, that is, which session, this packet is going to get delivered into, because I want to get it queued in the right place for processing. Okay? So at this lowest level of packet classification, you can break this down into multiple layers, but conceptually, the classifier actually has to violate the layering boundaries of the networking protocol, right? We tell the story about the seven-layer network abstraction, right? And as I think it was Tannenbaum's networking book says, this may or may not be a good way to implement networking stacks, but it's a wonderful organization plan for writing books about them. That's as close as I've ever heard Andy come to sarcasm in print. That's let me translate that. Right, the seven-layer model sucks, and nobody in their right minds builds a networking stack that doesn't fuse the layers. Certainly, the classifier has to violate the layers. So what you would discover is you would discover in the early networking stacks, people wrote ad hoc classifiers that just knew what all the protocols were, did whatever classification they could get away with, got however far they got, right, and then basically pass the packet on to some other layer which would maybe do some more work or maybe not. This is a pain in the neck because it turns out that in order to get the correct identification for the packet, there are places where you have to do a lookup. You have a field in the packet that has a known value, and that value is associated with some connection on your machine. Right? So specifically, the packet is addressed to a port number, and you want to know what socket that goes with. Okay, and so there's a table lookup scheme. This table lookup scheme, it turns out there's no good way to do it. Because there's a high dynamic variance in the number of open connections. You could have two, you could have 2 million. Well, 200,000. And there's no single data structure that's really easy to do in a kernel that has that kind of scalability that's really easy to manipulate. I mean, you tend to do kernel data structures designed for sort of a steady state of number of items in them. Right. Hash tables just, yeah, there are hash tables to scale this way, but the algorithms are complicated. And in any case, you really would prefer not to do an out-of-cache memory reference. Why is it out-of-cache? Well, you just read the packet into your cache. Right? So whatever else was there is gone. Some clever people at Berkeley did something called the Berkeley packet filter. So here's the idea. The idea is, if the packet's going anywhere, ignoring some low-level control packets, which you always have to handle, but you can think of those as sort of pre-established sessions that are part of the design. If the packet is just not going to be dropped, then I have a session for it. Now that session may be as simple as a routing rule that says here's what to do next with the packet. But if it's going to somebody locally, somebody somewhere did a bind call on the socket or a connect call on the socket. And at that time, I knew enough information that if you asked me, can you write an algorithm that given a packet would say yes or no, does it go to this particular socket? Well, I know what the packet's going to look like and I could write you that algorithm. Now imagine that we were to write that algorithm for every connection that we make. So the next question would be, now I have a set of these classifiers, each of which does a single kind of connection. Can I build a program that, given a set of classifiers, will merge them into one aggregate classifier? Right? So the gazinta into this aggregate classifier is the packet, right? And the gazata is the appropriate socket connection or the appropriate next stage handler, right? And it does the demultiplexing. Well, the answer is yes. It turns out you can write the classifier in a very simple kind of language, right? It knows how to read a byte at this offset, and based on a value, it does a dispatch, and then it reads a byte at some other offset, and based on a value, it does a dispatch, and then it gets to the end and says, aha, here's the answer. One advantage to building these classifiers at connection setup time is that at connection setup time, I actually know what all the possible values are, so I don't have to do any table lookups. I know what the actual port number is for this connection. OK? Okay, and that means that I can actually do the demultiplexing directly in the packet classifier. I can do it with constant compares, if I'm careful. Because I know what all the constants are. What the Berkeley guys did is they said, what we need is, what we'd like to have is some kind of a specialized instruction set for writing these classifiers. The reason we want a specialized instruction set is we want something simple enough that we can analyze it for safety. We want to make sure, for example, that it does not do an out-of-bounds reference on the packet. Right? We want to know all the references are to valid locations. We want to know that it doesn't do a reference to some arbitrary location in kernel memory. Right? And we want to know a few other things about it. We want to know the determinants. That would be good. Right? It'd be really bad to start a classifier and enter an infinite loop in the kernel. This is, you know, there's only one error to this, and it involves hitting the reset switch. Okay. So they designed a bytecode language to do this. Oh, and they wanted a bytecode language also that would have the property that its execution flow was sort of mostly linear, because if I have sort of a linear structure classifier where there's basically no loops, and they didn't quite get away with no loops, but conceptually, if I had something with no loops, and then I have a bunch of sort of linear threads of classification code, and it becomes relatively easier to merge them into some kind of a tree classifier that takes in a packet and does the fan out. Okay. So they designed a bytecode language to do this. The problem with a bytecode language is that while bytecodes are not as expensive as people like to make them, there's an art to bytecode design. And if you want to do it fast, there are ways to do fast bytecode interpretation. As far as I can tell, the people who designed the Berkeley packet filter were very focused on the packet filter problem, and neither understood the Tao of bytecode design nor the Tao of bytecode interpreter design. And they got out a bytecode interpreter that was not at all bad. In fact, it was pretty good. And I think there was probably another factor of 5 to get out of it if it had been a little more carefully done. That's me speculating. I don't actually know that that's true. I haven't looked at it carefully. But the bottom line is, bytecodes take work to run. And one of the things that you'd like to do, very often you're doing this classification at a time when you're going to be copying the packet anyway, or certainly the portion of the packet that the classifier is looking at. So you'd actually like to fuse the classify with the copy, if you can possibly do it. So Dawson's looking at this, and he's unhappy about performance. And Dawson says, what we should do is not run an interpreter. What we should do is we should generate code directly. Rather than spill out the bytecodes and then interpret the bytecodes at packet classification time, we should basically design a little hypothetical RISC machine. And I think the one he chose was based essentially on the MIPS part. And instead of emitting bytecodes, we'll emit these MIPS instructions. And they won't really be instructions that we're emitting. What we're really going to do is we're going to call these macros that take the same arguments that the instruction takes. And then what we're going to do is on a per machine basis, we'll have a library. And when I issue an add register, 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 the library knows how to write out whatever my native machine instructions are to implement a 3-register add. And it appends those to some buffer. So the protocol is, okay, I want to start a new procedure, and the library goes and allocates a buffer. Okay, now I want to issue an add instruction, and I want to issue a load instruction, and I want to issue a jump instruction, and blah, 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 blah. Now I'm done. And as each of those instructions gets issued, the library has been translating them on the fly into machine code appropriate for your machine. So the advantage to the bytecode system was it was machine neutral. The disadvantage to the bytecode system was it was machine neutral and it was slow. So Dawson says, okay, we need a machine neutral interface. To heck with this bytecode stuff, let's go for a RISC instruction set. And let's accept that there's going to be a machine specific component in here. There's no way to avoid it. I mean, you either were going to do the machine specific part when you compiled the bytecode interpreter, or you were going to do it when you compiled the classifier. But one way or another, there was machine code in the picture. So what we should do is design a very simple library and we'll emit in this machine-neutral assembly language, right? And we'll just generate machine code. We're not going to try to optimize it. We're not going to try to do anything fancy with it. If the library emits two or three host instructions for every assembly instruction, right? We get a factor of three loss in instructions issued. That's still better than a factor of 100 loss in interpretation. And in fact, on RISC machines, the vast majority of the time, the VCode library generates instructions one-to-one with the host. And it's penalized on Pentium because it was designed for a RISC instruction set. All RISC instruction sets today are basically three address instruction sets. The Pentium is two address. There's no terribly efficient way to do that. And it's a nuisance. But so the idea is basically come up with a code generator where your goal is speed of code generation, not speed of generated code. And then what he did was he moved the bytecode system to user level, right? And he generates the bytecode tree in exactly the way that the Berkeley filter did, I believe, or comparable, right? And then having generated the tree, he emits machine code for it using this VCode library. And all the machine dependencies are encapsulated inside the VCode library. Okay. And then turns to the kernel and says, here's the emitted code, go to town. And this is coming from a trusted application, so the kernel's willing to believe it. Now, why is this important? Why is speed of generated code important? Well, speed of generated code is important because every time you open up a new connection, you're going to rebuild this tree. So the speed of regenerating the classifier is actually important because that becomes potentially a limiting factor in the speed with which you can open up new connections. Okay. So from BPF to DPF, the jump is from a bytecode interpreter to this machine-generated code approach. And a factor of 10 to 100, depending on the application you look at, performance improvement. This idea gets revisited again in slightly mutated form in two later experiments. So one is an experiment called TIC-C. And if you're interested in compilers, go off and read the TIC-C paper. So Dawson has this incredible habit of coming up with very simple, very elegant ideas that in hindsight are completely obvious, but they're, you know, sort of brilliant at the time because nobody's tried them before. And so he said, aha, you know, there are times in compilers where I'd really, really like more information than I can get statically at compile time. Like, if only I knew that I was looping, you know, from zero to something, and if I knew that something was a multiple of 4 or a multiple of 8, I would know how many times to unroll the loop. And I could eliminate a whole bunch of checks that the compiler has to do for loop termination, because if I unroll the loop at compile time and it turns out that the loop has an odd number of executions, well, in order to check for that, I have to insert tests and jumps inside the loop. Yeah.
This is about what you were discussing earlier. It seemed to me that there was one classifier for each open connection.
Let me come back to this. Let me finish the statement I'm making and then I'll take the question. All right, so the idea is I'm going to unroll the loop, but if I do it statically at compile time, I'm going to have to add extra checks. If I knew that I was always going to get a multiple of 4, and then I could say, hey, I'm going to unroll the loop 4 times, and I know it's got to be multiple of 4, so I don't have to do any of those extra checks. And if I don't do any of those extra checks, then I don't clobber the condition codes with these checks that mostly aren't going to do anything. And I don't insert these forward branches whose purpose is to exit the loop early in the cases I'm not likely to hit. And by the way, because they're forward branches, they have the property that the processor tends to predict them wrong. So they're quite expensive. And clobbering condition codes is quite expensive because it turns out there's only one condition code. And so you get forced, at the compiler perspective, you get forced into generating the condition code and then using it immediately. If you clobber it in the middle, then you got to regenerate it, and that's a nuisance. So Dawson says, wait, right, what we need to do, right, this is joke, right, that you can solve most problems with one more level of indirection. Well, right, the other way is you can solve more the most problems with sort of one more layer of interpretation. So Dawson says, ah, we won't have the compiler generate code for the loop. We'll have the compiler generate code that generates code for the loop. Okay, and what we'll do is at runtime, when we enter the loop, we'll test what the bound is. And based on knowledge of what the bound is, we'll make a decision about which strategy for loop generation. We will dynamically generate the code for the loop at runtime and then branch into it. Now, here's the deal. Suppose you're going to run the loop 100 times. So if I can eliminate a compare and a branch in each of those 100 loops, that's 200 instructions. If it takes me 10 host instructions to generate each target instruction, right? Now, if the loop is 20 instructions long, I'm at break even. I can generate the loop and then execute it just as fast as if I left it alone and generated it statically. Except that most loops don't run 100 times, right? The interesting loops are the ones you suspect are going to run several thousand times, right? And in those, this strategy really does pay off. Okay, just another application of deferred, low overhead code generation. Good. Sorry I didn't take it earlier. Let me come back and take a question.
Yeah, it seemed to me earlier that when you were talking about the classifiers, that there was one classifier for each open connection.
Yes.
So it seems to me that there's a bit of code duplication here. Let's say you have three DCP connections. Each one's classifier is going to say, "Am I a DCP? Is this a DCP
yes.
segment?" And so you could have a two-layer thing where you register a common DCP classifier. And
but there is duplication in the initial classifier. But remember, there's a merge pass, and the merge pass takes all that duplication out.
Okay,
so all of those TCP classifiers are going to start with a sequence of instructions that says, check the protocol field of the header, and if the protocol field of the header is not TCP, then we're done, it's not me. Right? All those are going to merge into one check. Right? It's not a naive blend, it's an optimizing blend.
And that's where the bytecode comes useful because
it's easier. Yeah, so the bytecode is very narrow in what it says. And it's well tuned to be optimized by the thing that merges the classifiers. Okay. So I want to talk about why are these classifiers okay? Okay, and they have two critical properties. The first is that they're safe, and the second is that they're terminating. You can inspect this code and see that it terminates. And in general, that's a very, very hard problem. But for filters, that turns out to be pretty well tractable, assuming we use an appropriate language for expressing the filter. In fact, not only do they terminate, you can give a reasonably accurate estimate of how long they take to run.
Sorry, something which surprised me along that line. You mentioned with Berkeley packet filters that the specification allowed for loops. I had never encountered that before.
What I said was, I didn't think it allowed for loops. I didn't remember.
Oh, okay.
If it does, I'm pretty sure it restricts the loops to bounded loops, constant bounded loops. And the reason I suspect it might is there are places in the classifier where I may want to execute a copy operation. And I would, if I were designing it, I would actually introduce a copy bytecode that just said, you know, here's the base, here's the bound, do the copy. Because then I know by design that it has this terminating property. But I don't know what they actually did, and I have not actually looked at the bytecode language that was used by the Berkeley packet filter. I am fairly sure that if they do have a loop construct, A, it's a constrained loop construct, and B, it's used in a very idiomatic way. So it's okay to loop as long as I know the base and the bound at static compile time or in static analysis time. All right. So safety and termination, which brings us to exokernel. We often talk as though there were only two choices for protection in systems. One is address space-based protection, right? This is the kernel versus user story. And the second is language runtime-based protection. And, you know, I explained early in the class why one should be a little hesitant to accept the language runtime-based arguments, because the runtime is a very, very large thing. But that's a little contrived, that statement, because one could imagine verifying. I don't know that anybody's done it, really. But one can imagine verifying large parts of a language runtime. But there's a third option. Okay, and the third option is one that had been exploited in the Berkeley packet filter, but if you go back and look at the packet filter papers, it's not clear that the authors understood explicitly. I mean, they knew as a matter of intuition that this stuff was safe and then it terminated, but I don't know that they realized that they'd actually broken an important boundary in this protection issue. And the first paper I've seen that recognized this explicitly was the exokernel paper. And it's the exokernel paper in which the notion of a UDF is introduced, or a universally deterministic function. Now, a universally deterministic function has two properties, three properties. It's safe. It's terminating, and its output is a pure function of its input, which means I can cache the answer.
What do you mean by safe?
Safe meaning that I know that it does not access memory in ways that would violate the type system. So in the case of UDFs, I can design a UDF with local storage, and all of its memory references are going to be either to its arguments or to local storage. And conceivably, we can extend that to explicitly allow references to system data structures by idiom, but that's what I mean by safe.
Yeah. Did you just say that the people who designed the bytecode something about a boundary, they went past the boundary?
Yeah, and I'm going to explain that right now.
Okay.
Is that what you're about to ask?
Yeah.
Okay. So, this last part about it being a pure function, I'm not actually convinced that that was necessary. Right? They, in the exokernel work, they use this for caching purposes, and there are places where you want to be able to do that. So being able to do that is tremendously useful. But it's something that actually, I would also like to be able to write universally deterministic functions that considered things other than their inputs for certain applications. And they're deterministic if you look at them over all of the inputs, but not all of the inputs are arguments necessarily. But they didn't do that. Here's the interesting part. So the problem in exokernel, or the challenge in exokernel, is how do I build a very small, minimalist microkernel on the one hand, and on the other hand, have it be something that's extensible? And there are things, and we looked at an example yesterday, like the interrupt probe, where I really, really would like to be able to add just a little bit of function to the microkernel. I'd like the boundary between the microkernel and the application to be ever so slightly more porous than the strict classical supervisor user boundary would allow it to be. For example, I want to be able, going back to interrupts, when I get an interrupt on a line, and I know that a given driver is associated with that line, but the line is shared, so I have three of those drivers. In principle, I could ask each of those drivers to give me a filter function. What the filter function would do is it would say, if you probe here and you test there and you read this memory location, okay, and you turn a 360 degree and you take two dance steps to the left, then you'll know that it's this card over here. And if I could get a specification of that flavor for each of the cards that's actually on the system, then at interrupt time, I would know not just which line the interrupt came in on, but I know exactly which card had to be dispatched. And so now what I could do, before I had this vector of queues, each for an interrupt line. But if those interrupt lines are shared, then really what's happening is I have a somewhat larger vector of logical interrupt requests. And there's fan out. Somebody's got to figure out, when I get the hardware level interrupt, at the pin at the processor, somebody's got to figure out which logical interrupt that was. Way out at the other end of the bus, that interrupt happened on a specific card on a specific pin, but by the time that information got to me, it had lost some resolution. I no longer know precisely which pin, at the card point of view. With this kind of probe logic, I can get that back. Well, why would I want that? Well, because the alternative is that I'm going to wake up an intermediate party who's going to wake up each of these drivers in turn and say, I've got an interrupt. Is it yours? And for any given interrupt, you know, if I've got three shared things, two of these parties are going to say no. And four context switches later, I'll have managed to find the right driver. But if I could demultiplex the interrupt earlier, then I'd say, okay, what I'll do is I will reconstruct the logical interrupt information. And I'll actually be able to start the correct driver and not do those extra context switches. And if I can describe the probe protocol using some extension of this universally deterministic function idea, and we're not going to be able to do quite what exakernel did with this trick, but if I could extend this idea, then I could say to the driver, hey, one of the things you can do when you come up and you go out and you fill up the bus and you discover, yes, there's a Wombat 3000 peanut butter sandwich card in slot 2, turn around and hand the kernel a filter that says, and if an interrupt comes in, here's how you identify if it's mine. Now, these filters are not going to be quite as simple as the exakernel UDFs, because they're going to require talking to hardware registers, and some of those operations are potentially unsafe. So our criteria for checking them are going to have to be a little more stringent. But after all, we have to trust drivers anyway. They do things like DNA. It's actually not insane. We still want to do some checks, just for sanity. I mean, there's always the possibility that the driver will hand us one of these things and it'll just be wrong. What did they use these for in the exakernel case? Packet classification? File system construction? Right, some really clever things that didn't get down to the device logic. But the point is, this idea that I actually could download code across the boundary. And in the UDF case, I might know that that code was safe by virtue of checkability. And more generally, I might know that it was safe either because I checked it or because it came from a trusted source within the architecture. And the point here is, the function of the kernel, in this view, is not a fixed thing. Right? It's a thing that's a little malleable. Now, right about now, if you're somebody who thinks about high assurance and high robustness, your stomach's getting queasy. Because a lot of the basis on which we evaluate high assurance and high robustness code is predicated on the assumption that the code you're examining is actually the code you're running. And code that sort of morphs itself on the fly is something that, as far as I know, we actually don't have a good principled handle on how to evaluate. I know how to describe to you what the safety check for a UDF looks like and why it's okay. And it might be that for purposes of high assurance evaluation, you could say, and here, I'm going to call an unspecified function. And that unspecified function has the properties that we know it only runs so long, we know it's deterministic, and we know it's only going to touch certain memory locations. But having said that, these are conditions that we are going to check elsewhere. And at the moment of this call, when you're looking at the code performing the call, you're just going to have to take them on faith that they've been checked elsewhere. So We have a constrained interface. We have a statement of what the contract is in the interface, but it's an opaque interface because we don't know what code is going to end up on the other side. Now, these interfaces can be done, and I think they can be assured, but it's a sophisticated kind of analysis, and it's one that one should be rightfully a little nervous about. Pluggability is not your friend in software when you're trying to do high robustness. People in electrical engineering who do things like buses, right, are operating at a different level. It's a little easier at that level. We don't know how to get that kind of rigor in general software interfaces yet. Okay, so, and by the way, I don't think, at the moment, I don't think we're going to exploit this in Kaios. I'm nervous about it. I'd actually like to play with it as a research matter, but it makes me very nervous. So, coming out of the bytecode, we end up with this flexible machine code generation scheme. And then we see that idea exploited for, sorry, machine code generation scheme, VCode. And we see that idea exploited in DPF in a variation in TIXIE, and also in, I think, in the exokernel UDF work. I distinctly remember seeing a successor to the VCode package in the exokernel tree. And this notion that actually, if you were a little careful about this, you could use this for protection. And one of the cute things about the VCode library, the VCode library is simple enough that you could probably assure it. I mean, it's literally the case that it does a very simple instruction decode, right? And according to the decode, it emits a couple of local machine instructions. And it would be not a fun thing to assure, but it is a piece of code that you really probably could exhaustively inspect. And then you could say, well, here are the criteria for safety checking, not based on the output code, but based on the input code, which is already in a constrained assembly language. Right? And now I have a way to say, okay, an application can turn to the kernel and say, or turn to some intermediary agent, but let me start with the kernel, and say, here is machine-independent assembler. The kernel has the VCode library in it in this story, which I think is not the right solution, but I'm going to start there. Right? And the kernel condition is, okay, I'm going to check it. If it's safe, I'm going to do native code generation, and after that, I'm willing to run the native code. Now, in fact, I don't think there's any reason to put that function in the kernel. I think the right thing to do is have an intermediate agent that does the checking and the translation and then downloads the final code that is in a trusted position. And the only distinction here, it's not that this reduces the amount of trust you have to have, it's that it reduces the number of mistakes that you can inadvertently make in supervisor mode. But this idea that there's a hard boundary between the application and the kernel, this is an idea that we need to challenge. And one of the things I said several weeks ago, I think, I was talking about the downgrade and how you enforce this transitive read-only idea. And one of the things I said is, anytime you have an entry capability, right, the ability to send a message to another application, if you're asked to downgrade it to something read-only, that the kernel has to take the conservative point of view that it doesn't know what the messages mean, and so the only way it can do a safe downgrade is to say, well, it becomes a void capability. But the reason it has to say that is it doesn't know what code is running on the receiving end. If we knew that that application was a memoryless application, to use Anita Jones's term, or if we knew that we were in a position to check the behavior and trust a checker, a less conservative downgrade would be possible. And we're exploiting the same intuition here, that we're downloading code potentially that we're in a position to check. And this check is not of the same order of complexity as the check that's used in something like the Java runtime, because the programs that we're talking about are much simpler programs. The code generation strategy is a very naive, simple code generation strategy. The VCode library is measured in hundreds of lines, not hundreds of thousands of lines. Okay. So there's a curious idea here, and it's an idea that sort of pushes the edge in various directions, and there are a couple of different things converging here about testing this boundary of how much really has to be opaque to the kernel. And in testing this particular question, I think the exokernel work probably should be classified as a brilliant piece of work. I don't personally believe that the systems that got built on exokernel are ultimately going to be of immediate production interest. I mean, there are some people doing things on top of exokernel, but from a research standpoint, the interesting question in exokernel is about, to me, is about probing this boundary. All right, other questions on this? Anybody awake? You're not supposed to fall asleep until after you eat the turkey.
Is vCode still around? I was looking at the website last night, and it looks like development has kind of stopped.
Development on vCode stopped before I finished my PhD. So there are two versions of vCode that I know about floating around. One is the version that's on the vCode webpage, and if I remember correctly, that one will generate MIPS or Spark code. I don't remember if it did anything else. There's another version of the library that targets x86 that can be found in the exokernel tree. It's slightly different. They were never properly merged. And actually, I at one point started something that I called Xcode, which was essentially, you know, a properly merged vCode interface with the bounce check implemented. I mean, there's no rocket science in this. Although there's an interesting question, which is, once I admit the Pentium into the set of targets, it's no longer obvious that the right form to use is a three-address form. And if I take the view that the vast majority of processors of interest in the world actually are Pentiums, maybe I even want to go to a two-address form and penalize the RISC processors, because statistically speaking, there aren't any RISC processors in the field. Now, I'm not quite clear that that's actually the right answer. There are actually a large number of embedded RISC processors. But hey, if I don't care about the last cycle of performance in this code, still a two-address form might be okay. The problem with a two-address form is it's harder to generate code for coming in, and so the end-to-end process might be less efficient. The other thing I was looking at with Xcode, vCode takes a very particular position about optimization. It doesn't do anything. Now, and it's really trying to do, you know, instruction-to-instruction code generation. There are a couple of middle grounds you could take to sort of make this more flexible. You could say, well, I'll have the ability to do optimization, but I'll also have the ability not to do it. I'll have the ability to do a register allocation pass, and I'll have the ability to turn it off. Right? But one thing I could do is, instead of emitting code eagerly, I could collect the vCode instructions into a buffer and then do an optimizing transform, right? It's just a question of when I'm going to generate the code, how much I'm willing to pay, and how much quality I want back. And there's a range of valid options there. Right. And I think you could have a lot of that range without severely penalizing the cheap case. In fact, I think you could get vCode permission, vCode performance out of the cheap case. So anyway, so there are two places to go if you want to look at vCode. The one disappointment is that those two vCodes don't accept quite the same input language. And that, at least, you'd want to reconcile if you wanted to use this for real. And it's a shame, I think, that that wasn't reconciled, because if you just took the existing vCode stuff, reconciled the two interfaces, and added the buffer bounce check, you'd have a general purpose code generation library that could actually be used by lots and lots of projects. I actually, what got me looking at Xcode, I think I mentioned this at one point, was record filtering in DB2. Right? So the way a database works, it goes out to a disk, it brings in a huge chunk of data. In the DB2 case, it's like 128 megabytes. It then does a filtering copy, selecting records out at the disk level, and it's actually the case in an aggressive database that it's compiled the query down to a filter specification that it actually runs against the records. Well, that's an extra copy step, right? And if that copy step could be fused right as the data is streaming off the disk, which you could do if you were going to use the DPF technique, right? You'd avoid the extra copy entirely. And I talked to some of the DB2 researchers about this, and the sense was, well, they weren't entirely convinced that this was where the bottleneck and then we got to talking about it a little more, and they said, well, the bottleneck is the I/O motion. I said, well, if you could cut the I/O motion in half, it would work. It would help, right? Well, maybe. You know, this is one of these things you got to test it and find out. But set that example aside. Right? There are a bunch of other examples. There's web servers that are trying to figure out how to associate streams of flow with basically serving objects. But there are lots of places where we do demultiplexing. This library, I think, has general application. All right, other questions? Okay. I will see you guys on Monday.